We know hunting for good coffee can be frustrating and time-consuming. And with all the confusing labels out there, it's hard to know that what you are buying is actually mindfully sourced and truly making a difference in people's lives. That's why we put together our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription. Over the last 15 years, Joe Bean Coffee has built friendships with award-winning coffee farmers, ones we trust to consistently bring us amazing coffee year after year. Coffee tastes best at the peak of harvest, which is why we run our program like a CSA, regularly sending you a rotating selection of in-season coffee. You pick how many bags and how often you need it. We do the rest. And you can feel good knowing you're directly supporting small-scale coffee farmers. Go to JoeBeanRoasters.com for details.
Heyo! Good morning, and thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Appreciate you ever so very much. This is kind of the last, you know, I don't want to call it the last Sunday of summer. Obviously, next weekend, Labor Day weekend. A lot of people kind of consider the final weekend of summer, even though technically, I believe we have almost a full month of summer left. But that all changed when I had kids. You know, September, to me, has always been my favorite month. And the reason I describe it now as my favorite month is because the weather. You know, I'm a fall and spring kind of guy. I am not a summer and winter person. Too cold, too hot, hate them both. Love me some late September weather. You know, so I've always loved September, but I describe it now as this. It's weather and football. Listen, I'm not too ashamed to admit. I love the fact football's back in September. What I used to say, though, I said September's always been my favorite month. What I used to say was the reason was because September is like, or to me, before kids, was like secret summer. You know what I mean by that? Secret summer? Because September is still summer weather, but it's like slightly more comfortable summer weather. But everybody else quits summer Labor Day weekend. Everybody else, Labor Day comes and goes and they go, ah, summer's over. And they stop doing stuff. They stop doing summer stuff. Everybody stops going to the beach. They stop going to, I don't know, amusement parks. I don't know why that popped in my head. Maybe because my kid and I go to Seabreeze a lot. But they stop doing all the summer stuff. You know, stop going to baseball games. They just stop doing everything that is like a summer activity. But September is still summer. So it was like less crowded summer. You know? I don't know. Is that making sense? Anyway. Appreciate you listening. As I mentioned, next week will very likely be a monologue episode, and then I've got a couple of good episodes lined up after that. I've got the dude from Spotted Duck Ice Cream coming on here in a few weeks. I've also got Kelly from Get Caked. She's going to be on in the near future. I actually never had her on even back in the radio days, so I'm really excited to have her on for the first time ever because I've just been a fan from afar for a very long time. But speaking of being a fan from afar, that is how I would describe today's guest. Tom Seymour is somebody who I have been a fan of for a very long time. I am almost positive that I neglect to mention in this interview that he is the president, the current president of the New York State Food Processors Association. How we talked for as long as we talked and that never came up, shame on me, but I want to make sure I get it into the intro. But he is just a connector. He is a guy, if you are in food manufacturing, food processing in New York State, really specifically Western New York, this guy knows everybody, and he has been responsible for, you know, just bringing a lot of leads to the table for us for no reason other than out of the kindness of his heart and because we're members of the New York State Food Processors. But just a connector, been around, knows it all when it comes to food processing and packaging, and now he's finally decided to start his own business, which isn't launched yet. So you're getting a little sneak preview into the planning process for that. Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy Tom Seymour, Mocha Energy. Coffee bean bars. All right, we have a lot to get to. This is going to be a two-parter spread out today, being part one, part two, probably in like January or something. But let me start with the question I always start with. Usually it's a few minutes into the podcast, but today, like right off the bat, if I were to talk to you on your high school graduation day, I know you went to McQuaid, so I talked to you on graduation day at McQuaid, what are you going to be when you grow up?
Yeah, so I thought that I was going to be a phys ed teacher. I wanted to go back to McQuaid and teach phys ed and kind of follow in the footsteps of my grandpa. And so I ended up going to SUNY Brockport for college.
Pursued a little bit,
played college ball. PSA for anyone out there listening that's thinking of pursuing college sports, make sure that you're a student athlete. Make sure you keep your grades up. I think kids today are smarter than we were. I was one of these guys that thought, like, I was a really good football player, offensive lineman. Got recruited by lots of schools, sat in conference rooms with coaches, and was dismissed many times because even though I was at McQuaid, and McQuaid is an already rigorous course load, I carried like a 75 average at McQuaid, and not one coach wanted to talk to anybody that didn't have an 85 average. And I unfortunately didn't take the SATs as seriously as I should have. I only scored a 980, not because I'm not bright. I think if I took them today, I'd crush them. Mm-hmm. But like as a kid, I was just like, yeah, why do I have to even do this? Yeah. If it didn't interest me, if you couldn't explain to me why I needed it, it wasn't going to. And even still to some point today, like I go all in when I'm in. If you can get me something I love and I'm interested in, I'm unstoppable.
No, I was the same. I was the exact same type of student. So like if I liked the topic, I was all in. Like I would get an A almost easily. But if I was bored in your class, I would barely hang on for a C.
Yeah, I was a history, social studies, me too.
Yeah.
Like I crushed there. Now, if you talk to my wife, she'd be like, what? She was math. I loved English language arts. I love writing papers. I love writing to this day. You see, I write articles for trade journals and stuff. I love writing. And I love history, and I still love history, but you know, you don't get to pick what you like when you're that age. And so you just kind of do what you do. And the long and short is I end up getting dismissed from a bunch of, 1AA scholarship opportunities. I only had one on the table. It was Wayne State in Nebraska, and it is out in the middle of nowhere. And as a kid, I'm a mama's boy, and I couldn't go that far from home. And so SUNY Brockport came. They were willing to take me with my 75 and 980, right? Yeah. They weren't as concerned with student athletes, I guess, at the time.
Well, now the Heidi's over there. Heidi's
yeah.
Standards.
Yes, I think since I've graduated, my degree has only become worth so much more because back when I was there, it was kind of like a party jock school.
Yeah, yeah.
And now they're
75
like...
75 was celebrated.
Yeah, yeah. Now they're very polished and like it's very much a more prestigious place. But State University was the most sensible, cost-effective. They took me on, allowed me to play some football there.
So did you graduate with an education degree?
No, I graduated with a bachelor's degree in an unrelated field. I hate saying it. So remember, I was trying to balance. I worked through at Applebee's through college. And what I would say is full time. I worked like 25 or 30 hours a week, which waiting tables is kind of full time.
Yeah.
Plus I was going to school full time, playing football, and trying to have a social life. So, I went to school for recreation leisure studies. So with a focus in municipal recreation.
Cool.
So most people don't think about it, but like the federal government has a recreation department. The state government has a recreation department. Every single town has a recreation department. When I was in school, Kodak had a huge corporate recreation department. And I fell in love with the idea. One of my professors was like, hey, I was the director of recreation at Kodak for 25 years. The guy made a good six-figure income, and his job was to plan fun activities for the employees or for people of the town.
Yeah.
I also did some study in therapeutic recreation, which is working with people with disabilities, which was also really interesting and rewarding. I loved it. As a young person, I thought this could be a really fun, cool way to like work and make money. But in the end, corporate recreation went by the wayside. And what I found in municipal recreation was they promote from within, which is great, but they want you to work for hourly wage for quite a number of years.
Yeah.
Their pension or pension jobs. So like you, the people that are leading those departments stay 20 plus years.
Yeah.
They don't come open often.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a really long time before you actually start making a decent salary.
Yeah.
And I've always been a hustler. Yeah, I've always been a hustler, and like I didn't see it in my future, but it got me through college.
So what's your first job out of college then?
So right out of college, I leaned into my hospitality background. So
bees,
yeah, yeah. So I started at the Holiday Inn as a dishwasher. So started in the dish pit, then moved into room service, which was awesome job. Bar back, bus boy, and eventually moved into waiter jobs. Worked at Applebee's for a lot of years through college and after, and then inevitably found myself looking to leverage that background and experience. So I said, look, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to work for the very best place in town. So I went and worked for the Woodcliffe and was the head waiter and wine steward. I didn't walk into that position. It took me quite a number of years to get to that position. But in the end, I was their head waiter and wine steward in their dining room for Horizons Restaurant. What I would say was the peak of the organization, the peak of that restaurant, was the time that I was working there. And I was making a lot of money, doing good. Like, the restaurant life is a fun life. So my son was on the way, and I was getting ready to go back to Roberts Wesleyan College for a master's in strategic leadership. I had been to a couple of meetings, and I brought the paperwork home that I was going to sign, but I brought it to my dad's house. And I said, hey, like, can we sit down and talk about this program? And he said, listen, please, please, please don't spend any more money on education. Like, try working in packaging. And I was like, because my dad was in packaging. So my dad was in packaging for his career, and I never paid attention or knew. Like, people would ask me, what does your dad do? And I'd say, oh, he's in packaging. And when I was looking to make a change out of the hospitality industry, he had been with Mako for, let's say, 13 years or so. And so his discussion was like, hey, what about packaging? Like they're looking, the Miller family's looking to bring someone in. Why don't you come in? Why don't you give it a try? Like, I'll help you out. I'll do this for 1 year to appease my dad. And then when it doesn't work out, I'll go back and get my master's, because I believe that that was the path that I had to take. So I went to work with him, and within a couple of months, I fell in love with it. I fell in love with, like, not only working with my dad and being able to spend that time with him every day, learning from him, growing, but I also saw a ton of potential in learning really specialized. So at Mako, when I got in, my dad was always military, medical, and industrial. So flexible packaging, military, medical, industrial. So really, really specialized stuff. And I was fascinated with how detailed and how almost secretive the knowledge was. And then at the same time, how collaborative and how much information was out there. So I started getting involved with different organizations. I knew I had a learning curve, right, to be able to overcome. My dad couldn't overcome that learning curve. He certainly helped. So I started going to, like, Institute of Packaging Professional meetings. I started then looking into educational opportunities with IOPP and so different organizations. Yeah. So I started just really geeking out, visiting facilities, learning, like, the entire supply chain, and spent a lot of time when there wasn't a whole lot of pressure to really get the roots and the foundation that I needed that inevitably helped me to get to where I am today.
I love it. I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's like a crossroads moment. It's like, oh, I'm going to keep going to education. I'm going to double down on this. And your dad convinced you to go into packaging, because this is where I think I start. Well, no, when did I first meet you? You were at Ledestri already when I first met you, I think. It's not important when I first met you, but yeah. You end up at Ledestri at some point. Yeah. Are we skipping a major step, or is that, like, next? Or
yeah, no, that's next. I think I met you my last year at Mako. So I was with them for, geez, I don't know, I'm going to say 8 years. You guys can fact check me.
You were at Mako.
You can fact check me on my LinkedIn, but I think I was there about 8 years. And they did both the flexible packaging and food co-packing. They did liquid and dry foods. So I learned both liquid and dry foods as well as flexible packaging. And I really got excited. I got to say that my dad suggested the move. Mike Miller, the owner of Mako Bag and the Miller family, Mike opened the door. So the family had a vote. I found out after the fact. His mom, Sue, is the sweetest lady. Scott and Sue Miller are some of the best people. But Sue was telling me at a company party one time, like, hey, you know, I don't know if you know this, but, you know, when you came in to interview, the family all put it to a vote. And we all voted no.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. But she's like, Mike. So I knew Mike. Mike was a regular of mine at the Woodcliff. And he would bring in his customers and entertain at the Woodcliff. And I'd take care of him. And he loved the service that I provided. And I loved that I got to, like, impress my dad's boss, right?
Yeah.
So we had that pre-existing relationship. So I guess when the family vote happened, Mike went to bat and he was like, look, I know this guy's going to do well. I know it. Like, I've spent so many hours with him at my table. This guy's a winner. I don't care what you guys vote. He's in. So he held the door open for me. If Mike hadn't pushed, who knows where I would have been, you know? So I have to say that, like, he was instrumental in opening the door. And he was, the reason I go back to Mike is because he was the focal point for the food co-packing. Craig, his brother, was more the flexible packaging side, and Mike was more the food co-packing. Prior to Mako PKG coming together, there was Mako Bag and there was MC Pack. Mike owned MC Pack. The family had Mako Bag, and I helped them to rebrand it to Mako PKG. And so I really took to the food co-packing side.
Yeah, you loved it. I mean, when I first met you, you were really knowledgeable already at that point. And I mean, you've even now, it's, you know, beyond, you're like the most knowledgeable person, but even back then you were so into it. I mean, it's really cool to me because it feels like you found your calling. Because, like, earlier we were talking about how through school, if something didn't interest you, you wouldn't really to, but this interested you.
Yeah,
you were,
yeah,
like, I want to know everything I can know.
Yep.
About this.
Yep.
So when you leave Mako, you go to Ledestri. Now you're going to work for a co-packer.
Yep.
Which is interests me, of course, because that's what we do here.
Yeah.
It's, I always feel like an ass anytime I compare us to Ledestri. It's not the same thing. That is the Yankees. We are Brighton Junior Varsity. You know what I mean? So it's not, but it is the same industry. So it's fascinating to me to learn. And I would just love talking to you about things when you were there, and still do, obviously, but love talking about things when you were there about working for the big sauce co-packer. So how does that leap happen from Mako to Ledestri?
Yeah, so my friend Lindsay Rinford had reached out to me on a number of occasions, and we just could never get the numbers to work. I will say that I've always been fortunate enough to be a good negotiator on my own behalf to make sure that I'm looking after my family, and I was well taken care of when I was working for Mako, making a fair living.
What's the secret to being a good negotiator? People need it, we need to hear 101.
It's standing up for yourself and knowing your worth, and not allowing people to tell you that you're not worth what you are. And, you know, just really standing firm to, like, what you need, and knowing that, like, at the end of the day, if that's where you're supposed to be, then it'll all work out. And being willing to walk away, and not from a negative standpoint, just saying, like, knowing that, like, there's a plan for you in life, and you have to know that if it's meant to be, it's meant to be.
You just said it. By the way, that's what I was looking for when you said being willing to walk away. I believe that is the secret to negotiation. Mm-hmm. I think that if you're in a room with somebody and there's a negotiation happening, that if you are truly willing to say it's this price or this cost or this salary or I'm out of here, that's the only right way to go. Because you're either going to get the salary or you're not going to get the job where you're being underpaid, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
being willing to walk away is the single biggest power move in any negotiation.
And by the way, like, how long do you last at an organization when you sign a deal
that you hate?
Or in this industry, like, say you sign on a sauce and you take it at, like, sub margin. How long are you going to want to run that? Every time that's on the line, you're like, this is a loser. Why am I continuing to do this?
Yep,
yeah.
Yep.
So you have to, like, one, you have to gauge, like, where you're at and give yourself an honest assessment. I identify myself, and I don't mean to sound like someone that's proud or bragging. I try to be a very humble kind of servant style leader. That's where I like to keep my headspace. But you just have to know that, like, you have value, and you have to be willing to stand up for that. And you have to make an honest assessment. Like I'm a sprinter. Like I know that about myself. I categorize people as like walkers, joggers, and sprinters, people in our profession. Right. So I know that I can't hang with walkers. I can hang with joggers and I can hopefully influence them to occasionally sprint. And the same frustrations that I have about the joggers, they have with sprinters, because we're going at different paces, but we're at least in agreement that we should be moving a little bit quicker. The walkers are the tough ones. So if you're a walker, you need to know you're a walker, and you need to understand that you might not have as much value, or you may not be able to command as much, but just be honest about that. So like, I know I'm a sprinter. I know the value I bring. I know who I am, how I work, what I can do for a business. So when I go in to sit down with someone, it's very plain. It's like, this is what I need. This is what my family needs. Mm-hmm. I know I'm worth it. I know, by the way, when I say I know I'm worth it, a lot of times people forget that, like, you have to talk in business terms. What's the return on investment? If you're going to pay me this amount of money, you have to be able to tangibly show that business owner, boss, whoever, what is the return on investment?
Yeah.
If you can easily point that out, and by the way, that's in every aspect of life now. Like, I'm constantly talking about what is the return on investment. You have no problem getting what you need. So Lindsay and I went back and forth for a couple of years. I never was able to get the number that I needed. And then she called me up and she said, hey, we really want you to come on as a national account manager. We'd like you to take Kraft Heinz and Nestle as your key accounts. It's like a pretty significant, I don't know if I can say the number because I don't know that it's public, but it's a very, 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 very large book of business. And we'll pay you what you're asking for, or close to what you're asking for. There was like a bonus program that would get me to where I needed to be. So I signed on, and I thought, you know what? It was on my bucket list to work for Ledestri. Like, it had always been something. I waited on Ledestri. So the Ledestri team would come in for Christmas party at the Woodcliffe. And so for years I was their waiter, and I always said to myself, someday I'm going to work for that company. And so when it became an option, I was like, okay, this is on my bucket list. Like, I want to work for this company. I want to work for this family. And so, yeah, I was fortunate enough to get the chance to go to work for them. I wasn't there too long. I was only with the company for 2 years.
Can I ask you a quick question about account manager as opposed to sales? Is it the same thing, or those different jobs?
I wish someone would have pointed that out to me when I joined. That's why I didn't last as long as I would have liked to. So I created really great relationships with the family, and to this day still maintain those relationships. They're some of my favorite people. It's funny, the Millers absolutely love the family, the Ledestris absolutely love the family, the Hammer family, and now the Zagoda and Stryker family. So it's funny, the relationships that get made with the family owners. I tend to, I guess, gravitate towards that. But I wish I would have thought about the difference between account manager and business development or sales. So my vision was I was going to go in and grow and grow and grow and grow and help Ledestri continue to expand. And that's not what they needed.
And you're going to work with Kraft Heinz. Yeah. You're going to work on new Heinz products. Yes. Like, that's so cool.
Yeah. And really what it was managing the existing book of business. Mm. It was a lot of like contract negotiation. Mm. They had a very thick contract that, like, almost on the weekly, you know, you're going back and forth, like, talking about contract, and there was very little focus on new product. There was very little focus on new sale. I did bring Rouse to the table, which John Ledestri and I were very excited to celebrate bringing him to the table, but it was at the wrong time for the organization. And as a result, they had to turn it down at that time. Today, I think they might have picked it up through the Campbell's program, because Campbell's a longtime Ledestri customer. But at the time, they weren't ready for it. And, you know, for me, I was out trying to build sales, find new, right? Like, go out and find the big sauce companies that they didn't have, because they have most of them, and bring them in. And
how did you find that? Was that easy, fun, hard, very hard, somewhere in between?
Yeah, for me, I guess I'm blessed that it's easy. It comes natural. Like, I love making new connections. You know, I'm naturally like a hunter, a self-built type person. Like, I have no problem going out, meeting people, finding people, talking to people, and usually closing business. Like, that is a skill that comes kind of natural to me. So it was actually quite easy. The harder part was the internal sell. And at the time, the management team, they've since restructured their management team. But at the time, the management team was much more conservative on new business. And I just got to a point where I was like, I don't like account management. Mm-hmm. I don't like taking existing business that I've done nothing to add value to and just deal with the tactical day-to-day stuff. And at one point, my boss at the time said to me, like, you need to stop trying to be a salesperson. We don't need a salesperson, we need an account manager. And like, that was the conversation that I was like, okay, I guess I'm done, which pains me because I love the family so much and I love the organization. Yeah. I'd be there today still working if I had had an opportunity to be, like, I wish I could go in a time machine and have joined 25 years ago when Frank and Alan and Joe were building the business with Giovanni and John and Stephanie and like, and go in and like build those key accounts. Mm-hmm. It turns out I'm not so passionate about just managing the mm-hmm. the daily, you know, struggle.
Well, I know a sauce factory that is looking to hire a salesperson. So, you know, anyway. So after Ledestri, you go back into bags, you go back into packaging.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that like, so another great Woodcliff regular of mine was Jim Hammer and his wife and his kids. And I always tell people this, you can judge a lot about someone by how they treat their wait staff. And I know that because I did it for like 15 years. And the Miller family, the Ledestri family, the Hammer family were some of the best people I ever waited on in a restaurant. Yeah. So when the time came and I was like, geez, what do I do? I want to be at Ledestri, but I got to pivot away. I saw the time was coming to an end. My boss didn't really see the value in what I brought. And I knew that if I stayed around, eventually she would just cut me because she didn't see the value. She didn't want a salesperson. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to exit gracefully and say that I missed flexible packaging. That was the reason I gave. So I went over and met with Jim, and he was looking for, he had just brought on a flexible packaging department and was looking for someone to grow it. And I thought, oh, that's a great opportunity. I know the family, they're great people. It's a brand new department. I can help grow this. This is kind of the time machine I was looking for with Ledestri. I'm in. So I jumped in. What I didn't know is that when Jim interviewed me, he had already positioned the company for sale. Mm. And within like 45 days of joining, it transitioned from a family-owned business to a private equity-owned business.
Mm, that's a tough transition.
And it rolled up under Fort Dearborn, which at the time, Fort Dearborn didn't have a great reputation in the industry. And Hammer did. And so all the customers were like, oh, you're part of Fort Dearborn? Oh, we don't want to do business with them. Like, we love Hammer, but how can you join? How can you go to the dark side? It's like, hey, I didn't sign the papers. Like, you know, so I dealt with that. And then worked to convince the people at the private equity firm that it was a good private equity. I think it was Advent International, who at one time owned Rao's. They owned a whole bunch of great brands, really good private equity firm, Advent. So I was like, oh, I could last through Advent. Like I'm going to convince these Fort Dearborn guys that flexible packaging is something they should keep. Cause again, these are label people. Like they don't see the value in the flexible packaging. And they seemed at Fort Dearborn to really be interested in the flexible packaging. About 45 days later, the private equity firm flipped us to another private equity firm that also at the same time bought Multicolor Corporation from another private equity firm, and they rolled it all up under Multicolor Corporation. And right out of the gates, the talk was like, we want to be the biggest prime label supplier in the world. Like flexible packaging to them was like the furthest thing from their mind. You had like hundreds of salespeople now that had all been rolled up. They had to cut. I knew a cut was coming, and I knew that they saw zero value in the flexible packaging department. So I made the decision after 10 months to leave because I believed that they were going to close my division. 6 months after I left, they closed the division, sold off all the equipment.
Smart move, buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so what I'm hearing through all this, though, is a secret entrepreneurial tendency that maybe even at the time you're not quite yet recognizing as entrepreneurial, because you know, you are when you're a salesperson, it's like you're running your own little business.
Yep.
And when you're at Ledestre, then you're actually trying to like trailblaze, right? And like become a sales, you're finding major accounts and bringing them to the table. And then same thing here, like you're showing all this foresight. And I remember when I first met you, Mocha was not a thing yet, right? This brand that you've just created. And I think I asked you, and when I asked you, your answer was, everyone says that. My question was, when are you going to start a business? You were like the most entrepreneurial person I knew, but yet you didn't have a business. And, you know, everyone was saying that to you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I can remember Dan Rayo was one of the first, Dale Weed. I had all sorts of people all along saying like, hey, what are you doing? When are you going to do your own thing? And I remember sitting down with Dan Rayo and talking about, you just have to jump. Like you just have to jump. You can't stay like on the edge. You got to jump. You got to go for it. You got to take the risk. And I had every reason that I didn't want to take the risk. And, I told Maureen Beltori on her podcast that like, I remember as a kid, I used to pick up crab apples at my neighbor's house, for a penny a piece. And, I'd take the payment that she'd give me for picking them up. And I go to Wilson Farms with my brother. We were allowed to walk up there cause we were a pair of boys. My very, very contested by my sister that at like 10 years old, we were allowed 10 and 11. We were allowed to walk to the corner store and she couldn't do it till she was like 14. But anyways, we'd go up there and I would buy candy and I would put it in my wagon and then go back through the neighborhood with a bell, like a Skippy truck. And I would mark up the candy and sell it to the younger kids that couldn't walk to the store.
Entrepreneur, you know? From day one.
Yeah. So it goes all the way back to that. And like, when I go back through and I trace through like my college and like, I've always had some side hustle, some gigs, some entrepreneurial thing that I've been doing.
Even being a server is entrepreneurial. Yeah. You're running your section. Like you are running a little business when you're a server. Like, so this, the Mocha Coffee Bean Bar, bring me to the light bulb moment. And even actually, if I could go prior to the light bulb moment, was there any other thing you were considering before you landed on this idea?
Yeah. So I'm trying to think. I guess I should say that, like, you know, leaving Hammer, I found a spot, and I know it's a really long backstory. So hopefully if we have to break this into more than one episode, people stick around and listen to it. But I ended up taking a job with the Zagoda and Stryker family. Scott Zagoda, great guy. He's our age, which I've never had a boss that's my age. Mm-hmm. And sat down, had some lunch with him, and we decided like, hey, you should come over and work for Bison Bag. Bison Bag is in Lockport, New York. They produce flexible pouches and roll stock, and fell right into exactly what I was doing. They're obviously a way more established program than what Hammer had. And so I thought, geez, this is great. This is easy enough. I can jump in here and really make some impact. They were looking for a hunter, someone that could grow. They're very entrepreneurial themselves, like giving me a lot of space to do my thing. I love that Scott's philosophy was like, look, as long as you're hitting your goals, you manage your time.
Yeah.
So I say that because that's kind of where the spark for Mocha finally came from. I always had the excuse, well, I have a day job. And if I walk away from my day job, we're a single income household, my wife stays at home, how do I swing making ends meet? Now I go to work for Bison and Scott is like so cool, such a great boss. And he's like, look, and by the way, I've hit my goal every quarter, every year. I've been over goal, you know, thank God, like I've been able to deliver on everything. And Scott has said, like, as long as you're hitting goals, you do your thing. So I let him know about Mocha. I told him, you know, that I had a friend and he and I were working on a project, and the project is inevitably what turned into Mocha. So I, you know, I've always had the entrepreneurial thing. I understand the food science piece. I understand the packaging, have the whole supply chain. I've mentored over 1,000 brands. I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. So I started thinking, like, I have an unfair roadmap to how to do this. And I have the connections upstream of the retailers. I have all this laid out. And at the time I was like 44 and a half years old. And I thought, And I apologize to anybody listening that, that
did you say 44 and a half?
44 and a half.
We can do that at our age?
Yes.
We can do half?
Yes. And the reason I say that, and I apologize to anybody that's listening to this that, that is in their 60s. And I'm not indicating that like because you're in your later 50s or 60s that you can't start something. I just know for me that the amount of bandwidth and effort and energy and time needed that if I waited, it takes at least 10 years to build this business in my head. Mm-hmm. So I thought if I start at 45.
That is so realistic. Oh my God. That is the most realistic thing I have ever heard an entrepreneur say. That was the most, that might have been the most profound freaking sentence ever said on this. Everyone thinks it's a overnight. Everyone thinks it's going to be overnight. The fact that you go into this knowing it's going to be 10 years is incredible. That just shows how much wisdom you do have about this business.
Thanks. Yes. Thanks. Yeah. So in my head, I'm thinking.
I'm 11 years in.
Yeah.
And I have been making a comfortable living for about 3 years.
Yeah.
That's 8 years of barely making ends meet. Doing this business.
I think I've told you this. I've counseled lots of entrepreneurs this. If you're getting into food, it is a get rich slow business. Like that is the name
What's
of the
game. Funny thing I said is the best way to make a small fortune in the food business is to start with a large fortune. That's another good one.
Yeah.
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 Welcome to the world of Punches and Popcorn, where we dive into the bone-breaking and kung-fu-kicking world of martial arts cinema. Join us on the path as we explore a new movie every episode, discussing the history, fighting styles, science, and more from a broad range of fight films. Everything from Bruce Lee to Jean-Claude Van Damme to John Wick. There's plenty of room in our temple of couch potato style. So listen in and subscribe to Punches and Popcorn on your favorite podcast app.
Hey, this is Wade Reed with the Level Up Podcast. How do you take your coffee? What's your favorite espresso drink? Do you prefer wash process or natural process coffees? If any of these questions interest you, tune in to the Level Up Podcast presented by Nominate Meals on the Lunchador Podcast Network. We're looking at every link in the coffee supply chain from growing and processing to cafe life and home coffee brewing to find the topics that will enrich and maybe even stretch your experience of coffee. So have a listen, check us out on Instagram and Substack, and as always, enjoy your coffee.
So my thinking was like, if I start now at 45, by the time I'm 55, I'm in a pretty good spot.
Yeah.
And then by the time I'm 65, hopefully I'm in a really good spot. And the other thought that I had is like, I've made millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars for lots of different people. When am I going to start making millions and millions of dollars for myself and my family? And, you know, just took all that passion and interest. And I love coffee and I love food. A little bit too much. And so I got signed up for Food Spark with Center of Excellence for Food and Agriculture.
Did you go into Food Spark knowing it's going to be a coffee bean bar, or did you go in thinking,
yes.
I don't know what it's going to be. Okay.
Yes.
But so my original question though, I still want to know, was it always going to be a coffee bean bar, or were you, when you were still in planning phase, when it was still just living in your head, were there other possible concepts?
Yeah. So I got to give you here some insight on the coffee bean bar. So I knew that I wanted to do something, and I knew I wanted to do something in CPG, consumer packaged goods. And I had met my co-founder 5 or 6 years earlier, and he had this coffee bar product, and I tried it and I was over the moon with it. And at the time I wasn't really focused on wellness or health. I was just, wow, this is tastes really good. I love coffee. I love chocolate. I love this coffee chocolate that he just gave me. And I lost touch of them, and you know, like 5 years went by, and now I'm in the mindset of like thinking about doing something myself. And I was talking with Frank Cavallaro. And I said, hey, whatever happened to that guy, Omar, whatever happened to that coffee product that he had? And it turned out that like they had a great idea, great product, but for a number of reasons, it didn't land. And so I met with Omar and I said, hey, you know, what would you think of like dusting off that original idea, giving me an opportunity to like make a whole bunch of changes? Because today, as it is today, is not anything like it was what he was doing, but the concept of like a coffee caffeinated bar that has the sensory experience of chocolate, it fell into that realm. I said, what would you think about partnering with me? And I can develop the product into something that I think would hit and sell. And I can use my background in supply chain and packaging and the relationships that I have to make this thing fly. And he was interested. And so that's kind of when I latched on to, okay, I'm going to latch on to this as the type of product. And then, like I said, I went to and took Food Spark just to make sure I had most of the fundamentals. It's funny, the guy that taught the course actually said to me like a number of times, like, hey, if you ever want to come back and teach this. But it's always, I always tell people, like, there's no such thing as redundant or review, because you're always learning something. There's always a nugget. Like, I don't know everything. So, like, let me sit down and hear. Let me make sure that I'm, and a second time, third time around, sometimes you're really,
yes,
you really absorb it. So anyways, so I went through that and started formulating and basically took what was a conventional, like, sugar, fat, coffee, like, nothing better for you, just a coffee bar, and created a better for you, clean label, energy loaded, chocolate like experience bar that's shelf stable, that fits into a really cool niche. Looking at that better for you candy set, like, if you go into Wegmans or into Whole Foods and you go venture into the better for you candy, you'll see things like Hubar, you'll see things like JoJo and other brands like that. It's a very limited set. There's not a ton of competition. So a lot of times when people hear bar, they think, oh, it's going in that nutrition bar aisle that, like, there's a billion products. No, that's not where we're going. This is a better for you confectionery product. So the product is low sugar, low glycemic, high fiber, prebiotic. It's vegan and gluten-free.
Yeah.
It has upcycled plant-based protein, 80 milligrams of caffeine per bar. So the equivalent of one cup of coffee, less than 200 calories. Nothing on the ingredients label is bad to put in your body. So it truly is intended to support wellness, but give you that permissible, indulgent treat that makes you feel like you're having something you shouldn't, mm-hmm. gives you the energy of the coffee, tastes great, and at the end of the day, you're not worried about going against your wellness. And I say wellness because maybe you're a gym goer, maybe you're not. Maybe you're just trying to be mindful of putting better, cleaner things in your body. Everybody's on a different wellness journey. But this product, it was important to me that what I'm putting out in the market supports people from a wellness perspective, because I see food as medicine and I know the healing power of food. And I don't think that we focus enough on making sure that what we're putting in our bodies is thought of in that way. And so that was kind of the genesis of changing from a conventional candy bar type recipe aimed at kind of gym bros as a pre-workout. That's kind of what the original idea was, and really custom tailoring it to this, like, clean label, better for you, permissibly decadent treat that goes into a grocery store that's more aimed, the target market is more of like women ages 18 to 55. That's where we've seen a lot of positive feedback.
Permissibly decadent.
Permissibly indulgent, permissibly decadent. So
that's great.
Yeah,
that's really good marketing. You using that?
Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah.
What was it like when you approached a co-packer? Man, you.
So luckily, I know a lot of the ins and outs.
Them all, yeah.
But it doesn't
hurt or help. Though,
it doesn't make me impervious. Yeah. It was. It's been difficult.
You probably know too much.
I know too much. I know too much. And I got to tell you, like, I'd be a terrible auditor because I'd be writing people up for I notice everything, right? Yeah. Because I'm looking, like, I have some accreditations for various different subjects that I go into someone else's plant and I'm always noticing the area, and, like, whatever, they're probably a point deduction on your SQF. It's not like they're closing your plant down, but I'm very, very, very critical. I want to make sure that I'm dealing with the best.
So hold on a second though. So, all right, for whatever co-packer it is you're using, are you a great client or are you a nightmare client?
I'm a great client because because I give a lot of grace and a lot of understanding because I've
been on that side.
I've been on that side of the table, but at the same time, I'm not going to get pushed around. So like I've had
You know, some of the times when they say no, you know, no, we can make that a yes.
Yeah. Or like, you know, you put out a proposal for a pilot run that let's say is $5,000 and it's like, take it or leave it. And I'm like, well, I know it's not take it or leave it. And, you know, I know the market and I know what's fair. And so that's given me the ability to go in and negotiate and say like, hey, like, I know you think you need $5,000 and I'm happy to give you $5,000, but I want you to give me $2,500 back as a credit when I run my first production run.
Oh, yeah.
So like using that kind of negotiation that I know from working in Copa and, and by the way, yeah, we could do that.
Yeah.
You know, so like thinking through like a lot of
that's a really good. Yeah. It's almost too good that I don't want it on this podcast.
Yeah.
But I've done that a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I honestly, I don't know if I should be admitting that, but I think that's a really good negotiation with R&D cost is like,
well, it's hard because there is a cost. I'm not going to say that like to a co-packer, you have the cost and there's no guarantee that any of us make it. There's a high failure rate. Yeah. And so you're protecting yourself.
If you do disappear, I'm going to keep all that R&D money. But if you become a client, I'm happy to use part of it to get going. I think that was a brilliant
And to me, that's like really living out the partnership, right? That's out of the gate. You're saying we're partners. We both have skin in the game versus the other way where it's like either you get what you want, which is the lowest cost possible, or the co-packer gets what they want and they get the most amount of money for the development part of it. Now, with this being fully developed and just needing to be transitioned onto manufacturing, like there's still cost, right? This isn't a conventional product that just drops into anybody's line.
Yeah,
risk.
Like, were you asking them to do things that were outside of their normal process for this bar?
Well, introducing coffee into... Like most of the co-packers I can talk to are chocolate bar manufacturers. This takes the coffee or the chocolate bean out of the recipe and replaces it with a coffee bean. Chocolate manufacturers don't want to clean out the chocolate to put coffee in. Coffee is a very specific flavor, right? So like you're asking them to do something way outside what they normally do.
So you're talking about a big changeover. This is a big changeover to run.
For most. So that's where like finding the right people that... They are used to doing some changeover. They're used to doing some different stuff. They're innovative.
So slightly smaller. Is that what you're
saying? Yeah. So both the co-packers, we've two co-packers that we...
Another fucking brilliant thing.
Yes.
You know what? There are so many times where somebody has come in and again, we're giving away all the secrets right now. And it's bad. I've done two things now that are bad for my business. There's been so many times where I've sat across from somebody who's like, well, I'm thinking about going with A, but I might go with B. And I'm just kind of like, maybe you want to go with both.
Yeah, we're not single source. We're qualified.
Yeah.
On the Copac side, we're qualified with two. I'm open and transparent that like that's the case. And like hopefully we can keep one as secondary and one as primary.
Yeah, that's the
but
idea.
Out of the gate, it's likely just gonna be an even split. And then depending on who's getting the job done and who we're more satisfied with, they'll get the lion's share of the portfolio. But you gotta have redundancy in your supply chain all the way through.
Yeah, you can't have all your eggs in that one basket.
Yeah.
What if COVID happened again? All of a sudden they're cutting the bottom half of their SKUs or something, and you happen to be on the bottom half. Like you need that. You are so smart.
And that's every single part of the supply chain. I was on this morning on a call for Bison Bag with one of my bigger customers. I'm not gonna say their name because I don't know that they want me to say it, but they were I was trying to convince them, look, I don't want the lion's share of your business. Qualify me as a secondary supplier. Let's pre-qual, let's do some trial runs, let's get the item set up, and then like a small percentage, 10% of your portfolio is big business for me at Bison. Right? And then if you have anything go wrong in your supply chain, you always have us as a secondary. And by the way, if I'm doing a better job, you can move 30, 40, 50% over. Right. And so I talk about that all day long on my day job. Like I don't need to have your 100% of your business, because no one should be putting 100% of their business with one supplier. Unless you're super, super, super small. And then, you know, you don't have a lot to spread around, but you should always have two sources for just about anything in your supply chain, so that if you have a problem, you can't get coconut sugar from supplier A, you have supplier B.
In some places, three. In some places, three. We have tertiary suppliers for the big, you know, the tomatoes, the glass jars.
Yep.
There's even tertiaries. So, like, it's
risk management. It's good business. Mm-hmm. So, co-packers have been a little bit easier to navigate because of my experience. Mm-hmm. But it still hasn't been easy. Like, we've had some stall points. That's probably the hardest thing for me. I said I'm a sprinter, and
it can be frustrating how slow the process can be.
Yeah.
Like, even at like lightning speed here, it can still be 8 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an eternity in my world. I want it tomorrow.
Yeah. And my urgency and speed compared to the co-packer is always going to be different. Yeah. So for them, they probably feel like they're moving quickly. For me, every day I'm chomping at the bit, like, I'm texting the poor. So maybe I am a pain in the ass customer. I'm texting the poor sales rep, like, hey, you got that information for me yet today? Like, I need it. I need to make some decisions. But it's true. Like, I wouldn't say it. I'm not just being a pain in the neck. I need the information because, you know.
Here's a real call. I'll tell you if you're a pain in the ass or not. Ready? How many? The one I'm holding right now, this came from like a full size pilot batch, or at least a partially full size. Mm-hmm. How many pilot batches?
How many pilot batches have I run?
How many did you run full size? Just as one?
A thousand.
A thousand. But no, not bars. I mean, how many batches? One batch?
One batch.
Full size. Yeah. Bench top, how many times?
Bench top, I've produced over 1,000 bars.
Many did they have to do for you? Bench top.
I don't think they had to do any. I think we went right from my benchtop samples that I sent down. So I've made over 1,000 bars.
So you had your formula, your process.
So I've done like
even your suppliers.
Yeah. So I have equipment that mimics the equipment that's at the co-packers.
You're a great customer.
And so I have a packaging lab in my house.
You're a great customer.
So out of the gates, I went out and I bought printed roll stock, and I started making printed wrappers because I have a packaging lab in my house, so I can make the wrappers by hand.
Did you buy that just for this project?
I have to have it for my day job, right? So like people ask me for hand samples all the time.
Yeah.
By the way, guys, if you're asking for a hand sample, it's me working in my home office, like on my pilot equipment, stamping out your samples. So I thought, geez, I have this equipment. I will just buy roll stock. So since the very beginning, I've made 1,000 bars. So maybe like 10 batches, 100 bars each time. And the first two or three times I put them in stock white wrappers and put a sticker on it. And then after that, I started making my own wrappers, printed, pre-printed wrappers. So as far as 600 people know, they would have believed that these were being made on a machine. You couldn't tell the difference between what I was making and what the factory's making. So we were able to send down our formula. Everything was done and developed. It was all pretty ironclad. It was just proving it out that like their equipment, which mimics my equipment, that it all works. It was more for them to prove that it works than for me to be assured that it works.
How did it go? Pilot run go well?
Good. Yeah, it went well. Like what we found was we need to invest in a tempering unit because they didn't think there was going to be concern with cross-contamination in the tempering unit. And then they realized that, oh boy, after we run coffee through our tempering unit, we have to take the whole thing apart and clean every single piece because we can't run chocolate. It'll even with pushing, you'll still get that coffee is such a strong flavor. Mm-hmm. And so they basically said like, look, so now I'm in the process of trying to figure out how to get a tempering unit specific for us. So, you know, that's a bit of a challenge. Like I said, that's like the hiccups and the delays and the challenges. I'm working on funding. We believe we've closed our lead investor. And we believe that we have a strong follow-on. And we have a couple of other checks that we've been kind of holding off on to get a lead investor in. So we're pretty confident that we're going to close our first round, let's say October. So we'll have the finances to be able to get the tempering unit, but we also need to get the product out and out into the market. And
what's your goal there? I know it was yesterday.
Yeah. Originally, I wish this is the biggest regret, guys. So when you listen to this, you know, think about this. If you're thinking about starting your own thing, don't tell people the date that you're trying to launch something. Like I told people January Then I told people May. Then I told people July. Then I said August.
All right.
Yeah. So I do believe that we're very nearly there. So I think we have a great COPAC partner in Chicago, in the Chicago area. I wish it was here. Alex Vignari, if you're listening, I wish it was here in Rochester with you.
Come on, bro.
Wish it was with you. But I know we're still pretty small. Maybe someday we'll come back and produce it right here in Rochester.
Alex has the capability.
Yeah. He can do it.
Come on, Alex.
Yeah, we're small. But eventually I'd love to bring it back to Alex. Funny story, and I know we're going super long. Funny story. My grandpa was his father's business partner. They owned three Italians, because my uncle Charlie was the other business partner. Three Italians owned a Polish bakery on Hudson Avenue called Wojciech's.
That's great.
Like, I don't know. I joke around. I'm like, that sounds like a pass through for the mob or something. But anyway, so Alex and I figured that out. Like, I went down and visited Alex for this project. And I went home and I said to my mom, like, hey, I met this guy, Alex Vignari, talking about, you know, putting the product over at his place. And she goes, Alex Vignari? She goes, that's Philip Vignari's son, I think. That's your grandfather's old business partner. And I was like, no, you're thinking, this guy's in chocolate. He's not in the bakery business. And then I went back and Alex goes, no. Yeah, your that's grandpa. And he said, you know, it's funny because we still use the, like, their corporation name. It was like their initials, like, I can't remember what he said it was, but like Charlie, Ignazio, and Filippo. So it was like C-I-F, something like that. Mm-hmm. So anyways, it was just interesting that like there's that history. So eventually I'd like to move it back. You know, I'd love to be able to produce it in New York, in Rochester. I'm thinking about down the road in the near future, maybe like buying a pilot line, putting it somewhere here in Rochester, being able to do like R&D, LTO, limited time offering, seasonal, and have some manufacturing right here in the...
You ever talk to Holy Childhood, Special Touch?
They're a possibility. My coffee bean, I call out my coffee bean supplier, which is Joe Bean Coffee Roasters over on Blossom.
We did kind of skip that you also have the beans.
Yeah.
Is this going to always be for sale or was this just for the fundraising? Or?
Yeah, so we did it for the fundraising. Okay. We do have the coffee beans up on our website, www.mochaenergy.com. They're $20 a bag. I know that's a lot for a bag of beans. They're really good quality beans. If you bought them from Joe Bean, you're probably looking at a $15 bag anyways.
Yeah, but you're also funding your business.
Yeah. It's so we're using it as
a GoFundMe.
Yeah. Like a GoFundMe, but yeah. I'm not paying GoFundMe. And Joe Bean had this program that basically, I, you know, on a crowdsource, you typically lose 40 to 50% of your raise. And with the Joe Bean program, I only lose maybe 20%. Mm-hmm. So it's like an 80% profit margin. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, every dollar that you contribute by buying a bag of beans directly impacts our ability, you know, pre-investment to be able to do the work that we're doing. So I thought of the idea, put it up there. Good way to get the brand into people's homes. It's the beans that go into the bar. So it's true to you know, the product that you'll eventually, and then it curates a really nice email list so that when the bars are launched, we can, you know, give special promotions and special deals to people that supported us early on. So there was a lot of thought behind that process. But I've also talked to Joe Bean about would they be interested in housing a pilot line in their facility. So yeah, right now we have a great partner in the Chicagoland area for co-packing. But eventually I would like to see if it can be rehomed back to the, you know, New York State and Rochester community.
We got to work on Alex, man. That'd be a good home.
Yeah.
All right. Well, at mochaenergy.com, as you said, the coffee bean bar. Can I keep one of these, by the way?
I brought all these for you because I wanted you to also give them to some of your employees and hear what their feedback is.
I will.
Just remind them that it's equivalent to a cup of coffee.
Yeah. I was looking at it. I was going to open one up right now, but it's late afternoon by the time we're talking, you know. They'll hear it when this comes out in the morning, but not tomorrow morning. Never mind. But as we are recording, it is afternoon. So I'm like, I want to, but also I wouldn't drink a cup of coffee right now, but I will first thing tomorrow. This is going on my desk. As soon as I get here tomorrow, I'm eating this freaking bar. I'm so excited.
So I will tell you, so many times I've been up doing test work on my pilot equipment, and it's like 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, and you have to taste the product. You know, like when you're making sauce, you got to taste the product.
Yeah.
You know?
So you're pounding coffee.
Yeah. There's been nights where I'm up to like 4 in the morning, like wide-eyed. Wired, because, you know, you don't even realize how much caffeine you've taken in. But yeah, there was some intentionality there about being responsible. You've seen some like over caffeinated products out in the market, like so really being intentional with that, like 80 milligram dose you equivalent to a cup of coffee.
A warning on here that says 2 bars per day, you know.
Trying to be responsible about it. Like, we want people to get their energy but not feel shaky and jittery. The beautiful thing is the formulation gives you that really great lift without that kind of jittery feeling. And unlike a lot of the other caffeinated foods, is a emerging trend out in the food space, and we have lots of competitors, but the difference is we're the only ones delivering on the sensory side of things, the user experience being a positive user experience. Every other product that I've tried, it's either not clean label and they've delivered on the sensory, or it's clean label and it's chalky, mushy, gooey. It's not, you put it in your mouth, you're like, I would never buy that again. Maybe you eat it if you're like stuck in the woods. But this product actually drives that like really positive food eating experience. And then at the same time delivers all those beneficial.
Do you look at every bar at the grocery store as your category? Or are you looking just at the subcategory of caffeinated bars or caffeinated foods?
I'm looking at the clean label confectionery space. So like I said, I'm considering like Hue and JoJo and Unreal, like those guys are all in my space. Like Unreal and JoJo don't make bars. I'm also looking at like other caffeinated bars. So there's a bunch of caffeinated bars that are like made from date paste or made from various different ingredients that are, some are like granola bars, some are more like a date paste bar, I guess is the best way to say it. And like, so those would be competitors because they're bars and they're caffeinated. But those are easy to beat because I'm telling you, I wish I brought them. We could have taste, maybe that, maybe on the next episode, I'll bring some and we'll taste test.
Yeah, we're going to do this again when Mocha is actually on the market. We're going to do this again. And yeah, let's do a taste test at that time.
Yeah, so I think I think we're getting close. I think we can safely say that we're aiming to have product available through e-commerce before the end of the year. And then we do have engagement with a really, really great retailer. And we're trying to aim for like a February cut-in.
Cool.
To like really still capture some of that like New Year's resolution crowd.
Yeah.
You know?
Is there any interest in this? And by the way, if there's not, then don't worry. Do you want just like one small retail store just to do a trial in? Is there any interest? Because like Redbird would do it in a heartbeat. If you just want to just like, hey, I just want to quietly put it there and just get some random customer feedback.
Yes.
Like, nah.
No. Yeah. Our plan is, so again, going back to like all the experience that we have, I should have mentioned. So Omar is one of my co-founders, and Jessica Kwong is a co-founder as well. She's also the founder of Jack and Friends Jerky. Graduate of Cornell, degree in food science. Both of them are amazing, amazing, amazing team members. And we've, because of our experience, we've talked about intentionally growing it small and strategic, building a cult following, focusing on e-commerce and local independent. We do have one major national retailer that we are very excited about. But aside from that retailer, we're not going out and pushing this into any other retailer right now. We're looking at like Redbird, Dell's, Barry's Yoga Studio, my wife's hair salon. I've talked to Jake at Project Lean Nation, at Lean Life. Craig from Andy's Candies said, yeah, send a case. I'll put them out, see how they go.
Yeah.
Like being very, very intentional about supporting and utilizing that local independent retail space the first year, e-commerce and local, and then that one retailer, right? And then when you have that build and you have that cult following and you have that bit of success, now when you go to the rest of the retailers, you're not begging and pleading for them to take your great product on their shelf, because by the way, everybody has a great product. you're able to make a very clear business case.
Yeah. Again, just showing your wisdom there. You've heard it a million times and I've heard it a million times. Folks who are coming to the table with, but this is the best you've ever tried. It's like, it's good, but they're all good.
Right. What are you doing on the business? We go back to ROI. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put your product on my shelf. What's the ROI for that retailer? How do they make their money? And by the way, how do they, like, they're not interested in just, well, we're going to take Polly's business and we're going to shift it to Tom's business. They want to know what is the lift? What is the unique customer? What are you doing to increase the spend, not just shift the spend from one person's product to another person's product? And by going out and doing that work and being strategic and building that following, now when you go in, you can say, hey, we have thousands of people that are buying. We can direct them through promos over to your retail location. And you have to know, why is your product different? How is it positioned different? Why is it not just a Me Too? How is it going to drive people into that aisle that maybe don't go into that Better For You candy set to find the product and then might pick up not only my product, but a competitor's product or another product in the aisle and increase the cart spend, right? Like, you have to think from the grocer's mindset on their business. And if you're thinking about how you can build their business, you'll always get in the door.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just to relate that a little bit, if I could, to myself and what I've been doing for the last few years, I love doing co-packing because it puts me on the same side of the table. Like, for example, dealing with the local major retailer, you know, when we're making products with their label on it, it's not me on this side and them on that side. We're on the same side. We're on the same team.
Yeah.
And man, when you're on the same team, you're unstoppable.
Yeah.
It's you're so much wisdom. I appreciate you coming on doing this. I know we went a little long, but that's all right.
Yeah, I appreciate
it. We'll do it again in a couple months when this is out. I'm predicting January. That's my prediction.
Yeah, yeah. If January is the date, I'd be fine with it. I'm hoping to get it out to people sooner because I got a lot of people waiting for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do have a pilot run scheduled for October. So that's why I'm thinking end of the year by the time it gets made and run and in the warehouse. And the website's already up. The e-commerce stuff's already there. It's all set up. So it's just getting it in stock. So it is very possible to have it by the end of the year. But
I mean, I was just guessing.
But yeah, but who knows? Who knows, guys? This is the truth about food business, is that there are all sorts of obstacles. I guess I would leave you with this final thought. It's not about the peaks. It's about the valleys, right? Success isn't found in the peak. Like, the peak, the highlight reel, that's unfortunately how society runs today. We're all addicted to social media and seeing everybody posting their highlight reel, but that's not the measure of success for me, right? Like, it's pretty easy to get to the peak and pat yourself on the back and be like, yeah, rah, rah, open the champagne. We made it. The true measure of success for me is in those valleys, because there are a lot of valleys when you're a food manufacturer or food brand, and how you navigate those valleys to get from one to the next and eventually get to the peak, that's the measure of success. And so working as hard as we can to just continually remind ourselves that we're all in the same grind, we're all dealing with those valleys and obstacles. It's very hard to predict. Like I said, I hope it's the end of the year, but something could come up. But again, figuring out, how do you navigate through it and how do you drive success in the face of adversity to be able to reach that peak?
That was a perfect ending, bro. I'll talk to you again in a couple months.
All right. Sounds
hopefully
good.
Hopefully in real life before
that. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Lunch Hour Podcast Network.